Welcome to the debate. You know, when you step on a digital scale in the morning, the machine gives you a precise number.
Right.
And it feels entirely objective. Absolute, really. I mean, it's just gravity and mass.
Yeah, there is no arguing with the physics of it. It is a clean data point.
Exactly. But that single number doesn't tell you if you are building healthy muscle or if you are dangerously dehydrated.
Wow, yeah.
Or even if you are quietly spiraling into a psychological crisis regarding your body image. It just reports mass.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, your whole day, your mood, your behavior, what you consume starts to organize itself around that one metric. You don't just measure your weight. You begin to serve the scale.
You really do.
So today we're asking, is human civilization doing the exact same thing with GDP?
It is a profound question, and it sits right at the heart of the growing movement to move beyond GDP.
Right.
We are realizing that optimizing our entire global society for a single metric of gross domestic product, which, you know, essentially just tallies up monetized transactions, is leaving us blind to the actual health of our civilization.
And I think we both agree that shifting from narrow economic indicators to broader measures is absolutely necessary. Things like human well-being, ecological sustainability, and social equity.
Without a doubt, the Beyond GDP movement is a necessary evolution.
Because if we only measure economic output, we count an oil spill as a positive event because of the money spent cleaning it up.
Right, while completely ignoring the unpaid labor of raising a child, for instance.
Exactly. But the philosophy we are examining today introduces a massive complication into this shift. It draws heavily on Humberto Maturana's concept of relational biology.
Yes.
And it kind of forces us to ask a rather uncomfortable central question. As we move beyond GDP, should our measurement systems fundamentally shift away from being objective, standardized tools of institutional management, and instead become relational, subjective instruments of localized collective learning?
It is a massive pivot. And, well, it is the core of our disagreement today.
I'll be arguing that measurement is never a neutral mirror. When we measure something, we aren't just reflecting reality. We are engaging in what Maturana calls an act of distinction.
Mm-hmm.
By deciding what to measure, we are actively drawing a box around a specific piece of reality and ignoring everything outside that box. I believe that to truly move forward, we must completely abandon the traditional command and control logic of measurement.
Abandon it entirely?
Yes. We have to replace it with a focus on creating enabling conditions and prioritizing relational repair.
And I will be making the case that while our indicators absolutely must become more responsible and participatory, abandoning objective standardization is a critical mistake.
Okay.
Standardized, technically valid indicators remain an epistemological and practical necessity. Without a shared objective baseline of data, we cannot make invisible harms like pollution or inequality institutionally consequential.
Let's start with how we got here. GDP didn't just describe a world, it actively brought forth a world. It created a reality of production, consumption, extraction, and just, you know, endless growth.
It certainly organized our attention around monetized activity.
Right. Now, the mainstream Beyond GDP movement says let's just swap out GDP for a well-being or a sustainability dashboard.
Which sounds great on paper.
Right. But I am arguing that this is entirely insufficient if we maintain the exact same command and control mindset.
Insufficient in what way? I mean, if a government starts measuring carbon emissions alongside financial growth, isn't that a clear upgrade?
It is an upgrade in data, sure, but not an upgrade in relations. True progress requires a relational upgrade. We have to recognize that an observer, whether that is a centralized national statistical office or a localized indigenous community, brings forth reality through their specific distinctions.
Okay.
When the centralized office measures well-being, they do it from a mindset of management and control. They want to know the numbers so they can pull policy levers from the top down. We need to move away from the logic of measure, rank, and manage to a logic of measure, reflect, converse, and repair.
See, I come at it from a different way. I acknowledge that measurement is an act of distinction. By choosing to measure carbon, we make carbon visible.
Exactly.
But we have to remember a crucial philosophical baseline from the text here. Reality is not arbitrary.
Right, but
Now, let me just finish this thought. While establishing legitimate localized coexistence is a vital ethical foundation, we simply cannot discard the coordinative power of broad, standardized indicators.
But those broad indicators always flatten local nuance. They just do.
They do flatten things, yes, but they are necessary tools to coordinate attention and action on a massive global scale. Think about the uncounted realities of our world right now.
Like what?
Marginalized communities facing toxic chemical exposure, declining global ecosystems in the deep ocean, unpaid caregivers isolated in their homes.
Right, those are huge issues.
And without rigorous, objective, and standardized indicators, these realities remain entirely invisible to the macro systems of power. A local conversation doesn't change a national budget.
Well,
we need objective metrics to make those localized realities morally and institutionally consequential at the level where major resources are allocated.
I mean, that brings us right to the heart of the matter, the nature of objectivity itself. Modern measurement systems operate on this illusion that the observer stands entirely outside the world, neutrally describing what is there.
Right, the view from nowhere.
Exactly. But Majorana challenges this stance completely. The observer participates in the world through their language, their history, their embodiment, and, you know, their institutional biases.
Sure.
A Ministry of Finance in a high-rise office, a disabled person navigating a poorly designed city, a coral reef scientist underwater, and a future generation inheriting our climate. They do not bring forth the same world.
I agree. They have different vantage points.
Right. So what appears universal or objective in global measurement is very often just a reflection of particular institutional histories and forms of concentrated power.
Acknowledging positionality, like the idea that who you are shapes what you see, that doesn't mean we abandon the pursuit of shared objective data.
Let me give you a concrete example. Think about a conventional indicator like a standardized municipal map. Let's say this map only shows highways and major commercial zones.
Okay, a standard transit map.
Yeah. The city planner looking at this map tells you it's an objective representation of the territory, but it only shows highways because the map maker prioritizes vehicular efficiency, commute times, and commercial transport.
Right.
By doing so, they have engaged in an act of distinction. And here is where Majorana's relational biology really comes in. The map maker's choices actively dictate the physical future.
Because the funding follows the map?
Exactly. Because the state relies on the highway map, all the infrastructure funding goes to widening highways. The local footpaths, the ecological corridors, the informal community gathering spaces, they aren't measured, so they aren't funded.
Mm-hmm.
Within a generation, they get paved over. They disappear from reality because they weren't on the map. The map literally created the territory.
I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that. Let me tell you why.
You don't buy the map analogy?
I buy the analogy, but I don't buy your solution. If we just say, well, the centralized map maker has biases, so let's throw out the standardized map and let every neighborhood draw their own subjective map based on their feelings and conversations, we risk paralyzing institutional action entirely.
I don't think it paralyzes it.
It does. Yes, the highway map paved over the footpaths. But if everyone is navigating by their own entirely subjective, localized map, how do we mobilize global climate funds? How do we distribute emergency aid during a hurricane?
We do it through localized coordination. We ask people what they need.
But how do you hold a multinational corporation accountable for polluting a river that crosses three national borders? A localized conversation in one village downstream isn't going to stop a multi-billion-dollar mining conglomerate.
I would argue that relying on the corporation's own standardized environmental reports won't stop them either.
That is why objectivity must become responsible, not abandoned. Look at the concept of avoidable harm mentioned in the text.
From Johann Gulting, right?
Yes. Identifying avoidable harm, like a population starving while their country actually exports food to wealthier nations, requires a baseline of shared objective data across different domains of relations.
But
if we don't have technically valid standardized indicators, the powerful will always find a way to dismiss the localized experiences of the vulnerable as merely anecdotal.
Anecdotal. Yeah, that's the word they use.
Exactly. If a village says, "Our water makes us sick," the corporation will say, "Prove it." Objective metrics, like parts per million of a specific toxin in the water supply, are the weapon of the weak against entrenched power. That's an interesting point, though. I would frame it differently. The tools of entrenched power are rarely the best weapons to dismantle it.
How so?
Well, you're assuming that the rational system of data collection exists in a vacuum. You are assuming the metric of water toxicity just cleanly triggers justice. But data is interpreted by human beings, and humans are driven by underlying emotional states.
Okay.
This is what Maturana calls emotioning. Human beings coordinate ways of living not just through raw information, but through recurring patterns of feeling. Every rational system rests on an emotional ground.
And how does that underlying emotion change the actual mechanical function of the indicator? Data is data.
It changes everything. Let's step away from the mining example and look at measuring poverty. The exact same indicator functions entirely differently depending on its emotional ground.
I'm listening.
If a state measures poverty from a grounding of suspicion and fear, that measurement becomes a punitive welfare system. It becomes mandatory drug testing to receive food stamps.
Right.
It becomes surveillance of single mothers to ensure they aren't hiding income. The metric is weaponized, but if you measure that exact same poverty level, grounded in solidarity and care, it becomes a transformative tool. It becomes a universal basic income pilot or unrestricted community grants.
But the data point, the poverty line, remained exactly the same.
Exactly. But a dashboard grounded in control becomes technocratic management. A dashboard grounded in care becomes a tool for relational repair.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot just plug a new beyond GDP indicator into an institutional system grounded in fear, control, or extraction and expect a different civilizational result. The mindset of the observer has to evolve first.
That's a compelling argument, but have you considered how large-scale institutions actually operationalize things in reality?
I mean, they operationalize things through bureaucracy.
Right. I agree that solidarity, love of life, and humility are vital ethical orientations. But how do you operationalize care at the federal level? Bureaucracies run on budgets, logistics, and supply chains, not empathy.
Which is precisely the problem we are trying to solve.
But an emotional regrounding, while beautiful in theory, is incredibly fragile in practice.
Fragile how? Why is care more fragile than control?
Because large-scale progress in a complex world requires capture detection, monitoring, and accountability. We are dealing with systems and entrenched interests that are highly optimized for continued extraction.
Right. If I am distributing food stamps to 10 million people, I need a hard, objective cutoff line. I can't have a deep, relational conversation with 10 million applicants.
But that's the point. The insistence on managing 10 million people from a single centralized desk is the root of the problem.
But centralization allows for systemic accountability. Let's go back to your dismissal of how we stop the mining corporation. You need the what before you can enforce the how.
Meaning what exactly?
If a mining company pollutes a river, we need a standardized metric of heavy metals in the water. That is the what. Because when that standardized metric hits a legal threshold, it automatically triggers a financial penalty that cuts into their profit margins. That is the how.
So you're relying on the market to fix the market? The mechanism of accountability relies on the objective standard. If a dashboard is grounded purely on localized care and conversation, I question whether it is robust enough to protect ecosystems from being liquidated for profit.
I see.
A mining conglomerate isn't going to engage in a localized reflection about relational repair. It's going to maximize shareholder return until an objective, legally binding metric forces it to stop.
I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective on that. Relying strictly on monitoring and accountability simply reinforces the very command and control mentality that caused these ecological crises in the first place.
How does it reinforce it? It's literally punishing the bad behavior.
Because when you try to force compliance through monitoring, you are treating living systems like machines. You're saying to the corporation or the hospital or the school, here are the metrics, now optimize your behavior to meet them.
And hopefully they pollute less, or heal more patients, or teach better.
But that rarely happens. All that does is generate performative compliance. It encourages gaming the system.
Like Goodhart's Law?
Exactly. Teachers teach to the standardized test rather than educating the child. Corporations offshore their pollution so it doesn't show up on their domestic carbon dashboard.
Well, sure, there are loopholes.
It protects the authority of the observer, the state, or the institution, while doing absolutely nothing to heal the underlying relational fractures. It manages populations instead of transforming relations.
But we aren't just talking about abstract relations or test scores. We are talking about physical survival. Let's look at the concept of organism-niche relations, or what is often called structural coupling.
Let's define that for a moment, for clarity.
Structural coupling is the idea that living systems constantly adapt to and conserve themselves through recurrent interactions with their environment. The organism and the environment shape each other.
Right.
Think about the realities of human biology. A factory worker literally metabolizes their shift schedule. It becomes their sleep cycle. It dictates their cortisol levels.
Wow, yeah.
A child breathes the atmosphere. The smog physically alters their lung development. A teenager's mind entrains to the digital environment. Their dopamine receptors literally structurally couple with the algorithmic feed on their smartphone.
Right. Life is a relational field. We are not separate from the systems we inhabit.
Yes. And because of that intense structural coupling, individuals are incredibly vulnerable to the environments they are forced to metabolize.
Absolutely.
If you have a child whose lungs are structurally coupling with particulate matter from a nearby chemical plant, or a teenager whose psychology is structurally coupling with an algorithm designed to radicalize them for engagement, you need intervention.
Yes, but
to break those toxic structural couplings, we need strong top-down policy interventions based on highly accurate objective indicators. We cannot simply wait for localized reflection and conversation to organically generate a solution while a child is breathing polluted air. We need command and control in those specific instances to protect the physical integrity of the organism.
I hear you. But Maturana warns us that living systems cannot simply be instructed from the outside. You can't just mandate an organism to be healthy.
But you can mandate that a factory stops poisoning them.
Right. But that doesn't mean intervention is impossible. It means intervention has to be understood as changing the conditions within a living system, not asserting unilateral control over it.
How is changing the conditions not just another form of control? If I ban a chemical, I'm controlling the environment.
It is different because of how the system responds. When you try to impose well-being from above using a metric, like, say, mandating that a city must reach a certain air quality score by fining local businesses, you get resistance. You get people gaming the system.
Right. But true intervention follows a different action cycle. It's called a life coherent action cycle. It starts with recognition and renaming, basically acknowledging the harm. Then it moves to the de-implementation of harmful structures.
Give me an example of de-implementation versus control.
Okay, think about a highway that was built straight through a marginalized neighborhood in the 1960s, causing decades of asthma and pollution. Command and control says, let's put air filters in the local schools and monitor the asthma rates on a dashboard to see if they improve by 5%.
Right, that's managing the harm.
Exactly. De-implementation says, let's tear down the highway. You remove the source of the structural harm, and then you restore the ecological margins. You plant trees, you build parks.
Okay, I see.
You don't have to command the community's lungs to heal. You create the enabling conditions, and the living system repairs itself. Creating enabling conditions generates actual learning and transformation from within the community, rather than just imposing a metric from above.
I absolutely don't disagree with the goal of de-implementation. Tearing down the polluting highway is the right move. But how do you identify what to de-implement without standardized metrics?
Well,
you need capture detection. You need air quality sensors across 100 neighborhoods just to even see the pollution disparity at scale.
That's fair.
There's a profound ethical principle here about legitimate coexistence. It means that those who are historically marginalized, migrants, disabled persons, other species, and even future generations cannot be treated as disposable.
Totally agree.
But how do future generations or ecosystems enter the policy conversation? They can't speak at a town hall.
They are represented through science, ethics, and frankly, a posture of humility from the observer.
Yes, and crucially, through rigorous ecological observation and indicators. The entire ambition of moving beyond GDP to make visible what our current economy conceals is the strongest impulse of this movement. We have to insist that visibility leads to changed relations.
Right.
The voiceless, the river, the future child, the unpaid laborer must become morally and institutionally consequential. And in the massive, complex, globalized world we actually live in, institutional consequence requires standardized data.
Yes, but
we have to ensure that indicators are answerable to life. Yes, I agree we shouldn't serve the metric, but rigorous measurement is the only reliable way we enforce precaution at a systemic level.
But if that rigorous measurement is still operating from a paradigm of domination and control, we haven't actually evolved. We've just painted the cage green.
That's a strong way to put it.
The fundamental takeaway from this philosophy for me is that progress cannot simply be a technical measurement correction. We can't just calculate the monetary value of a forest, add natural capital to the national balance sheet, and call it a day.
Because that's still extraction.
Exactly. That is still extraction. We must evolve the observer. We have to move from a paradigm of management and extraction to one of legitimate coexistence. We have to look at the boxes we are drawing around reality and ask what kind of world we are bringing forth with our distinctions.
Mm-hmm.
Are we genuinely expanding the capacity for life to thrive, or are we just creating a more comprehensive, highly accurate spreadsheet of our own decline?
I hear that, and I agree that we must never mistake the map for the territory. The emotional orientation behind the metric, like whether we measure out of care or out of fear, matters immensely.
Absolutely.
A metric should serve life, not the other way around. But my takeaway is that responsible objectivity is our best, most practical defense against avoidable harm.
Because it gives us a baseline.
Exactly. We cannot discard the tools of institutional accountability just because they have been misused by entrenched power in the past. Rigorous measurement remains our best institutional tool to practically enforce precaution, hold bad actors accountable, and ensure that the harsh realities of the vulnerable are not ignored by the powerful.
We are dealing with a profound tension here.
We are. It's the tension between the absolute need for actionable, standardized data on a global scale to stop catastrophic harm, and the need for deeply contextual, deeply relational understanding at the local level, so we don't just manage people like cogs in a machine.
But there is a powerful point of convergence in this philosophy that I think we both completely align on. It is the recognition that societies do not merely measure what they value, they inevitably come to value what they repeatedly measure.
Yes, the metric shapes the attention shapes the funding, and the funding shapes the physical reality.
Precisely. We started today by talking about stepping on a bathroom scale and how that single isolated number begins to dictate the reality of your day.
Right.
It changes what you see when you look in the mirror. It changes how you relate to your own body. You metabolize the metric.
You really do.
If there is one thing this relational philosophy urges us to do, it is to look at the metrics we use in our global institutions, in our local community budgets, and, you know, in our own personal lives, and ask, what world are these measurements bringing forth?
Are they bringing forth a world of control, fear, and endless optimization?
Exactly. Or are they bringing forth a world of legitimate coexistence, enabling conditions, and care? The question remains, when you take out your measuring tape, what reality are you actively painting into existence?